Welcome back. Another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have David Zetti on the show. He is the executive director of the Homeland Institute. David, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's great to be on here. And I think we're going to have an exciting discussion about the American regime.
The American regime. Now, this is spoken from abroad. I'm not going to say where, but do you define yourself as an expat or just a tourist?
I'm not sure yet. We'll see. I'm kind of moving around a lot. So
okay.
Yeah.
So the Homeland Institute. It's an anti-globalist outfit.
That's correct. We're looking at exploring humane and workable solutions to globalism and multiculturalism. And the primary way that we're doing it right now is through polling. We did two polls so far. The third poll is in the works. It's going to be on national divorce. But we're also going to look at going beyond polling, such as proposing model legislation and perhaps ranking candidates. So we have a lot of good stuff in the works. We're essentially a radical dissident institution, but we're going to be doing mainstream things.
Interesting. So now, would the SPLC define you as a hate group at this point? Or?
Well, I think they've accused Moms for Liberty as being a hate group and even track their alleged hate activities on a map. So I'm pretty sure, yes. I think that's because they classify everybody as a hate group.
Yeah, it's funny how things change. So what they do with the cultural nudging. I saw a video of a representative of the SPLC talking about Moms for Liberty, how it has been defined as a hate group because it's anti-LGBTQ.
How absolutely dare they?
How dare this? How could mothers raising kids be skeptical about giving homosexuals, lesbians, queers, transgendered, lunatics access to their children? That obviously makes them a hate group. That's, and the SPLC, although it's lost a lot of, I guess, prestige in recent years due to all the scandals, I think it still boasts like a $500 million war chest to wage cultural warfare. And that's just how, how important these NGOs or supposed neutral think tanks or organizations are to the usual suspects in kind of destroying heritage America, the war on normal people, if you will.
And a good point to make about that is that if these things like NGOs, pressure groups, polling firms, if it wasn't important, they wouldn't spend vast sums of money on this. They're not doing this just as a hobby. So that's why I think the Homeland Institute is important. It's almost the first time we've ever done anything like this and began playing their game. So it'll be fun. And we're doing it on a shoestring budget because, well, we're willing to work for cheaper and we're just better than they are. But I think it's just funny that they lavish these massive NGO firms with all this money and they're still woefully ineffective and just fail miserably at their job.
Yeah, they are.
We're going to take them on.
Yeah, understand the SPLC or the ADL or even, things like, National Endowment for Democracy. These are regime change operations, whether domestically or internationally, undermining local government, local authority, local sovereignty, family sovereignty. This is regime change. This is the technology for regime change. Similar way that maybe the Masonic lodges function as a technology for subversion in previous centuries. It's a similar model. It just changes. And there's a history here of malevolent scheming elites using things like tax-exempt foundations and NGOs to wage social change, cultural warfare under the guise of science, research, academia, and...
Charity is a big one where it's like, this is for charity. So everyone gets a tax write-off and they get to subvert, America or foreign nations. So this is kind of ridiculous. I think in the future, this will have to be tamped down pretty hard. These things are inherently political.
Yeah, there was a history, and there's a history in the United States, maybe we'll get into this, that maybe 60 years ago, then there was some residue of sovereignty, like in our Congress, you had the Reese Committee hearings into their tax-free foundations, the tax-exempt foundations, and how they were subverting what they would call the American way of life. Back then, there was an understanding of what that meant. Since the Culture War of the 1960s, that's become much more ambiguous and ill-defined, and that's on purpose, I think. But there was an attempt to look into these foundations. Of course, the investigation was duly shut down by the powers that be, which kind of tells you who's the actual sovereign in our society. It ain't the state, which is the problem. which we'll get into this book here. You read this, but this is a book published by Antelope Hill, a publishing outfit, which publishes a lot of provocative but very important books, things that, you know, don't enjoy major, I guess, publishing houses for obvious reasons, or, you know, I guess distribution on things like Amazon, because they're generally dissident. I'm not saying if you buy the books, look at the books they're off, they have to agree with perfect with everything they offer, but it does provide a lot of provocative, thoughtful information. And one of the course of these book, one of these books is The American Regime. It was written by Anonymous, which tells you a lot about the nature of the American regime now. We used to think
I know it's it's a land of the free, but the author can't even write under his real name because he fears, you know, retribution. I'm sure some black criminal could go off and start a blog about his issues and nobody would bat an eye on it. But
no.
They're doing, that's really the whole point of January 6th, was when it's really was to chill public participation. The whole thing was basically a giant, what in the arena of law we call a strategic lawsuit against public policy, mm-hmm. or public participation. That's what January 6th was, except it was a, you know, anarcho-tyranny instead of a lawsuit.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a war on civil society, a war on heritage America, which is why the participants, although most of them were probably well-meaning baby boomers, if not chronologically or of age, but at least spiritual boomers, if you will, who still buy into the American system, sort of the civic nationalism that defines America. At least that's what we're told. But it's to sort of paint them as white nationalists or Nazis or white supremacists, if that means anything, which is completely absurd. If you just go back, these were Trump supporters. You know?
Yeah, if you look at the most iconic J6er, which would be Mr. Chansley from Arizona, he definitely isn't. And, you know, bless his heart, he's a good man, but he definitely isn't a white nationalist. He's
or
a
Ashley Babbitt,
nationalist.
Right? Ashley Babbitt, for that matter. She's a veteran. She, like, bought into the whole American system. And
yeah, that's what really spoke to me about both the book and January 6th. If you look at the beginning of the book, there's a huge ode to all these political martyrs. And Ashley Babbitt, like me, wasn't just a veteran, but an Air Force veteran. So when she was gunned down by this barbarian savage in the back, you know, that should have been our joy, George Floyd. And all we got was chirps.
Yes.
Americans couldn't even write their congressmen, you know, calmly send a letter saying this is an atrocity or I don't approve of this. And that's what really got me, is that, like, I'm kind of becoming post-American or redefining what America is. I don't think we can or should save the whole sea to shining sea thing. I think we really need to narrow this down to, you know, maybe the youth of tomorrow or certain parts of the country. I really, there's no we anymore. And even conservatives, they're very much anti-racist, which is just a code word for anti-white. They're very lethargic. And yes, they were intimidated, but to let this go, you know, Ashley Babbitt should have been sparked, maybe not protest, because everyone was admittedly scared to go outside their house after J6. And a lot of leaders were essentially caught up in it, which, you know, J6 did decapitate a lot of the leadership, I think, especially amongst what we call normies. I'd rather just call them mainstream citizens. But no, it's...
And the American regime... again, this book moved you. You and I, we've both read it, and it is a sort of a, and I wouldn't say it's a repudiation, but it's an examination of the American system, the American government, how many Americans now think that America still represents them, their culture. But there's been a sort of I wouldn't say a revolution, but an erosion of heritage America and a gradual takeover of it. And it's become much more malevolent towards them, rather, of what America is. We see that with immigration policy, open border policy, this sort of...
I would say openly malevolent towards them. I think they were malevolent since before World War II towards us. They just had to keep up this facade of legitimacy because they needed cannon fodder for World War II, cannon fodder, or just people to serve during the Cold War.
Yeah, they're running into a problem now with recruitment because they become openly hostile and they can't get people to sign up to be cannon fodder for Israel or whatever foreign adventure.
That's great because we finally have leverage. I actually recorded a speech on this, which will be dropping probably on or about Thanksgiving, where I kind of delve into this more. I'll save it for then. But basically, we finally have leverage. Democracy, or whatever you call democracy, was basically rule the masses in finance, but finally men of quality, and it completely disenfranchised the people who ought to rule, or at least have more say in how things are run, which is men of quality, which is ironically how the founders set this up. It was not every Tom, Dick, and Harry voted, even amongst white men. It had to be, there were very high standards. Finally, men of quality have a say by saying no. And the regime has made reform impossible. They've made doing things almost impossible, or at least high risk. Well, I'm going to say let's lean into that and start not doing things. Let's focus on causing problems instead of creating solutions.
And yeah, this will be instead of a political general strike.
Yeah, essentially a white strike. And I think, so I hate suggesting that other people do things, rather just do them myself, like with my polling from the Holman Institute. But I think it'd be great if Sam Hyde or somebody made a movie and call it Day Without a White Boy, based on the movie Day Without a Mexican. And just show, like, you know, this is what happens when we're not around. The freeways collapse, quite literally. There is a freeway in my beloved California, the I-10, which collapsed due to a homeless fire. Yeah. And it's indefinitely out of commission. And 300,000 people use that stretch of freeway every single day. This, we're seeing the aqueducts fail in real time. And it's, they just keep, if they want to disenfranchise us, okay, well, build your own aqueduct, fix your own freeway, fight your own wars, see how that goes.
Yeah, and the American system appears to be grooming Gavin Newsom for the presidency.
They are, and that is just so terrifying based upon what he's done to California and how he is the most Machiavellian guy ever. I really hope his son, who watches Andrew Tate, hopefully maybe can rescue his son from Andrew Tate and get him onto American Renaissance. But I mean, that he is the last guy that they have. Like, Biden's cabinet has to be Jewish because they don't have any front men. Gavin Newsom's their last competent front man.
Mm-hmm.
He's a psychopath. He's basically the evil left-wing guy from American Psycho. He even looks like him.
Yeah, he actually screwed his best friend's wife.
Oh my goodness, this is, he's literally a movie character. This is, he's a meme.
And when he apologized for it, he goes, you know, that wasn't a good thing to do. That was a bad call on my part.
It's the dark triad trait. This is like, he is like a more successful version of Richard Cluster B. Spencer with these dark triad traits. I really hope his son just like mocks him ruthlessly if he goes to office. But it's good to see that the elites can't even keep their kids in line anymore. So
yeah, I kind of see him like getting up in the morning, like the character on American Psycho, explaining his routine.
Yeah.
Gavin Newsom's routine, his skincare and hair.
Yes, it's so sad. But it kind of does get back to the American regime. While there, like, there has been a shuffling of elites, where we went from like Anglos or Anglo-presenting types to the you-know-who, the Jews. Mm-hmm. And now it's like even the Jews are being replaced by these kind of their pet abominations that they propped up. Like, Gavin Newsom's the last guy. Like, going forward, I think these bimbo millennials, like these two White House press secretaries who are just Tweedledee and Tweedledummer, or Ilhan Omar, or these random transgender people, they're the way forward. Their regime is being, there's a civil war on the left now between the traditional kind of what I would call Hillary Clinton faction,
mm-hmm.
where they're Zionists, they present as orderly, they wield state power subversively, they're kind of sophisticating, though their level of sophistication is dropping. Well, they've unleashed these bio-Leninist hordes in 2020, and you can't, you summon forth Cthulhu, you can't put them down. They have been aggrandized now. And we've seen this in history happen before, where the absolutist French monarchs aggrandized the bourgeois so they could take on the aristocracy and squeeze them from above and below. Well, guess what happens? Both the aristocrats and the absolutist monarch all get decapitated.
Yeah.
This never ends well. Unleashing chaos doesn't end well. And these people did not learn from history. Which is amazing.
How do you control chaos? Chaos is the definition of not of having.
Yeah, it's like you're trying to, you think you can put a demon on a leash. No, this is not how these things work.
Or a golem, for that matter, right?
Yeah, it's like the little golems are turning on their masters now.
We're seeing that in the universities. They made a university a diverse, you know, radical hotbed, and now a few of the, I guess the, like the coloreds at the universities get a little uppity, and now the billionaires want to lash out and cut off funding, which exposes the universities are just instruments of the oligarchs at this point. these
yeah,
aren't.
It's like, it's great. It really does, I think, vindicate some of the things of the American regime where he looks at threes of power and says, well, based upon, gives them credit where it's due, and then says, well, this proves this is not, this is incomplete. So what would explain it? Really comes down to racial nepotism or the reign of chaos and really these grand, you know, it's Jewish question plus a bunch of stuff that's very metaphysical and kind of just the Kali Yuga and all that, which will might go over some people's heads, but at some point for most people, I think they could just accept that these grand metaphysical things and Jewish power are like one and the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now,
But
in the book, the author covers sort of, I guess you could say, people's Americans' perception of their nation, the state itself. Now, we know with the history that the American state has gone through many changes. The idea that we've had continuity is kind of, a myth. It's not correct because you had obviously the founding, and then you had, of course, the so-called American Civil War, which fundamentally changed the country. It centralized it. Then you had sort of the upheavals of the 20th century, the World Wars, the Great Depression, the rise of the managerial state coming from the First World War, Second World War. And you have the Great Society, of course, the Cold War with, huge bureaucracy, central intelligence, sort of that William F. Buckley wrote about in Commonweal, telling the traditional American right that just had to accept, the Leviathan for the duration of the conflict. We both know conflicts never end because conflict feeds the state itself and feeds the interests that feed off the state. So there's a dialectic there. He covers.
Yeah, we never got that peace dividend we were promised at the end of the Cold War.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember. I was a young adult in the 90s, and so I came of age in the 80s and 90s. So I kind of saw that transition.
I remember the 90s, and it's basically I really like the one quote where I think it was some French guy who said, like, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. I mean, I remember the 90s very well as a kid, and it was, I mean, part of this is pure nostalgia, but it was like a golden age. People were just more happy and upbeat. You
Yes.
know, we were deluded into thinking America was forever and ever and we're the best, and that all came crashing down.
But the rot was there. You could see
absolutely. The cultural
culturally,
rot was.
Yeah. I mean,
pretty
this is
bad.
The age of MTV,
I
and that's
know.
Sort of destroying, obviously the Generation X was affected by that. But even in the late 80s and 90s, I think the early 90s, Gene Kirkpatrick, or the UN representative, who was at the time considered a neoconservative at the time, she was not Jewish, of course, but she was a UN ambassador for the Reagan administration, talked about the end of the Cold War and talking about America becoming a normal nation once again. What she meant by that was not this garrison state, world policeman is becoming a normal nation. Of course, that would destroy a lot of people's, special interests, particularly the military industrial complex, and also the neoconservative plan for the new American century, if you will, right, to get America on board the Zionist project. Now, they didn't have to go through the Cold War, you had the direct conflict. So you had these conflicts that were stirred up in the Middle East, particularly 1990 with the invasion of Kuwait, that was urged, kind of fomented by the U.S. if you do the research there. And then, of course, you have the rise of terrorism, the convoluted history of Islamic terrorism, its connections to Western intelligence, and how Western intelligence, first created Islamic terrorism to undermine first the communist world, but also Arab nationalism. British had a long history of that, and also the Jewish role in that, the Israeli role in promoting fundamentalist, Wahhabist, extremist fundamentalist Islamicism to ruin sort of the Onan plan, where you create micro states and you destabilize the region, so you're the only one standing. And we see that now with Palestine and Jordan, the whole Middle East.
I think one of the biggest pieces of evidence for that is that terrorism has essentially evaporated. I mean, there are still random truck attacks and knife attacks, trucks of peace, as they call them, but full-scale terrorism is no longer a thing, and that is despite how the regime has completely lost the quote global war on terrorism, where they got kicked out of Iraq and mm-hmm. Afghanistan. So that really suggests not that they did the job and left because they're kicked out, but rather the whole thing was astroturfed. And to some extent, the CIA and other individuals and entities can kind of turn this on and off, or at least encourage or discourage it.
Yes.
The whole thing is astroturf. There's no crisis. I mean, the whole 9/11 wouldn't have happened if we hadn't let these random people in to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they shouldn't have been here. We didn't need to have TSA and all this stuff. You simply had to say, no, you don't fit here.
Yes.
This isn't your country. You have a different homeland. stay in your sphere of the world, in the world of Islam, Dar al-Islam, the house of peace, where you belong, and you have a lot of options. You don't need to come here.
Yeah, and of course, the alleged perpetrators were being monitored almost daily by the FBI and Israeli intelligence. Just raises
I
some
know, hey, and
questions.
everyone say the line again. He was on our radar.
It's like, oh, we just got it. Same with the 93 bombing in World Trade Center. It was an FBI operation. It was a sting operation, which actually was reported by CBS News. And people just forget about it. Oh, okay. It was a sting
That's a
operation.
big thing I want to touch on with the American regime is that, you know, we oftentimes attack boomers. And I think really it's not a boomer issue. It's a TV issue and a bourgeois issue. And going forward, the TV issue is no longer a problem because of the internet. And what's happened is that the regime, they had a playbook that worked wonders, miraculously well for decades and decades. But now they're having a crisis of competency because they do not train their replacements. And two, it's a different world. It's like how Wunderwaffen of fancy tanks and airplanes can be outclassed by artillery and SAMs. The whole TV thing and the cathedral, it doesn't work anymore simply because of the internet. And we have mastered information warfare, like how the Germans mastered Blitzkrieg. And they're stuck in the past. They're using the doctrine and weapons of yesterday's information war to fight today's information war. And they are scrambling to catch up while we naturally felt it in our blood. The youth of today know how to use technology. They're steeped in it. And all these old people, like people who I think of, you know, that old decrepit, thank God she's gone now, Dianne Feinstein. She never trained her replacement. She didn't know how to use social media. We know how to do it. And right now, we're fact-checking these liars in real time, like Jackson Hinkle, others, Keith Woods. Israel will pop up their atrocity propaganda to justify their own propaganda. I wrote an article about that. And within hours, we have debunked this professionally on X, and the whole world sees it. So nobody's buying this anymore. And they don't know what to do.
Yeah, it's funny. You watch someone like Jackson Hinkle or Jimmy Dore. These are people who are primarily associated with the left, and they're getting together people of the right to expose this. And so you have the breakdown, the left-right division that was created here. Isn't to say there aren't, you know, profound disagreements on any matters of policy, but it gets down to agreeing what's actually happening. There's a general agreement here, and they're just exposing it because it's so obvious, it's in your face now that they can't hide it anymore.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, like in the American regime, what I got from it is that the Curtis Yarvin's theory of the cathedral can be summarized simply as a synthesis of media and academia. But the author says that he's missing a key piece to this, which is Jewish power and nepotism. So really, the correct understanding of the cathedral is that it's a tool by which Jews use to rule society. Well, one of these two pillars has been completely knocked out, which is the media. Not completely, but it's been highly undermined. It's no longer what it used to be. It can't be relied upon.
Yeah, I think it's held in the same esteem that the Russians held Pravda.
Yeah, it really is. It's become like, and you see these big accounts like CNN or random Antifa associated stuff, they get no traction. Like, really, it's like we get more traction on Telegram than they do on these allegedly mainstream accounts with millions of dollars behind them. So they've gone the way of the Pony Express, which is beautiful.
There are still a lot of people buffaloed by it. I was engaged in a kind of instant messaging text debate about one thing or another, and someone cited Wikipedia. And I said, really? Wikipedia with a question mark? I was like,
I know, it's like you're better off citing my Urban Dictionary.
Yeah, I was like, that's like citing Yad Vashem or something. It's like, consider the source. I'm sorry. You know, but point taken. It just doesn't have the same prestige or total control, meaning there was a time when people believed Walter Cronkite, right? That isn't the case. You don't have people with the same, and it's a good thing because these people were psychological warfare agents too at the time. It's just a different era, and era society was generally more conservative. But the idea that Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather could tell you how it is and you'd believe it, those days are long gone.
Yeah, they refuse to check their optics, and to use modern parlance. I know it's kind of memey, but that's where we're swimming in the information age, so might as well use the language. But you know, people don't believe these memes anymore. They have alternate sources, and they don't know what to do, so they're very desperate. And too, academia is another pillar of this. So it's not just journalists being fact-checked. It's these prestigious universities. There's something I read somewhere where this whole publish or perish nonsense, which costs millions of dollars, everyone better off that these people stop their diary of the pen. But the academia has completely blown their optics. They'd besmirched their optics with both critical race theory being wrong. You know, some white boy gets, you know, all these critical race theory and other types of leftist propaganda being taught in class. Well, he can go online on Telegram, Twitter, fact check it. For example, some, they say that white people are evil or whatever. Well, gee, it looks like all the crime is black on white and hardly any white on black. Why is that?
Yeah, there's the FBI crime stats, and then there's what you hear in the lecture at a university. You know, wait a second.
Yeah, so really, one of my favorite sections of the book was when the author modified the cathedral theory of power and said there was kind of a third rail to it, which was the judiciary. So media has been trashed. Academia has been fairly trashed. There's still the judiciary. And this is what really interests me as a lawyer and a fan of Carl Schmitt. It's how the judiciary kind of, it's this weird thing where academia has a disproportionate influence on what they train their people to do, because you have all these legal articles and they're all written by these, you know, law school professors. Well, who are law school professors? Well, they're Jews, or they're people who have very much internalized Jewish thought.
Mm-hmm.
You go to any regular, just simply undergraduate, most of the textbooks have Jewish names. Law school, even for stuff like contract law, it's Jewish names.
But even legalistic argument is sort of Talmudic, right?
It absolutely is. And yeah. I think going forward, we're going to need to, or is Talmudic logic legalistic argumentation? Like, there's a reason why.
Didn't Christ chide the Pharisees on that? Being overly
I think
legal.
So, but there's a reason why the Jews and Catholics excel at being good lawyers, is that they have this, you know, logical thinking. I think you can have logical thinking and argumentation that's in good faith without bad faith. But the Jews,
I think the key is having a relationship with logos and nature. The Jews are antithetical to the logos and nature, as we see in their activism.
You need to also just touch grass at some point. All this theorizing needs to have some relation to reality. And I think a good thing to ask is, one, this Occam's razor, I know as a lawyer, is that arguments that might be correct will come across as wrong, and they usually are wrong anyways if they have a bunch of moving parts. So if you have to construct all these, if some complexity is usually a sign of being wrong, what is correct is usually more simple.
Mm-hmm.
The complication is simply to explain away inconsistencies or things you don't like. So the simple arguments usually go first in any type of legal brief, simply because not only do they sound right, or they usually actually are. And some arguments where, even though I think they might be correct, I won't include it all because I feel like I was grasping at straws. If I have to use this much words and logic and convolution, it comes across as fake.
Yeah,
it probably is fake.
Yeah, turgid prose or jargon-rich, you know, literature or what you're reading usually an indication you're being conned. It's your BS meter goes up, so it goes off, flies off the handle.
Yeah,
like
and
a,
that's
like
the
a,
thing too.
Like a diversity, equity, inclusion seminar. You're like, what is this person talking about?
That's what I like about the book too, is that it would take all these theories and ask, does this explain reality? Because if the best test of if a theory is correct is how much does it explain reality. And a lot of these theories, like the cathedral, get pretty far, but they fall short a little bit, or they explain a lot, but not everything, like anti-leftism. So,
yeah, a lot of contingent arguments, which are safe because you can blame leftists or even blame black people, right? That's relatively safe. There's a time and place that's accepted, actually, especially if a black person's criticizing Jewish power, like Ilhan Omar.
Yeah. Well, that's happened too, is that I think we bullied Turning Point USA and Charlie Kirk, at least, into, you know, going after black power and talking like American Renaissance, even though Mr. Taylor is still tragically banned from X. It's, in a way, they killed us, but we're living on. We rose like a phoenix, and we've made the controlled opposition shills take a lot of our talking points.
Yeah.
So there's still work to do.
Yeah, you know, when I read something like cathedral theory, I think it's not so much incorrect as insufficient, and what it doesn't talk about is important because Chris Yarvin, I think, is Jewish, right?
He is, and I think the author said something like he seems to be uncomfortable with how there's too much evidence, not enough of it. He's obviously biased because of his ethnic background, which is true. I think you can always, when someone's testifying on the stand, you can explore bias and for their credibility. Witness credibility is a thing, and I think we can't always, parse out the argument from the person making it because people have biases. They have. And there is ethnic collusion. I think there is a strong, I don't think he's full on malicious, but I think there is some major bias coming from his Jewish heritage. And that's the thing too. When we have these many textbook authors and journalists all being Jews for less than 2% of the population, they don't speak with an American voice. They speak with a Jewish voice. I'm part Hungarian. I think Hungarians are great, but if all the media was Hungarian in America, you'd have a very Hungarian view of things. That might be for the better because Hungarians are very blunt. They're going to tell it like it is. They're very conservative, but in a chill way. They'll tell you that a spade's a spade and they'll complain a lot. So you would have a lot of complaining, but be very truthful complaining. But it'd be a thing. If there'd be a bias there'd be a coloring and a flavor. And I'm not going to recoil from admitting that. Well, the same applies to Jews. They're not special either. It
Yeah,
really goes to how the legal system, all the I think it's the top four or five constitutional scholars in America, if you can call them that, for the dribble they create, are all Jews. And the people rely upon their case, their argumentation, and their law school articles that they nurture for argumentation to destroy the Constitution.
Yeah, if you let Jews dominate the legal profession, don't be surprised that it becomes increasingly Talmudic.
Yeah, this is how things are.
Yeah, and it has, and that's undeniable. If you look at the way the law has been interpreted to advance their interests at the expense of the host system, host primarily Christian society. I mean, this happened in the 20th century. I think this is again. You mentioned Carl Schmitt,
Yes.
the German legal theorist. Now, of course, he's kind of known as the Nazi lawyer, which is kind of unfair
It's
in
totally
many.
unfair because he actually he, all the revolutionary conservatives were ended up being very anti-totalitarian, and a lot of them got in trouble with the German regime. Ernest Jünger and Carl Schmitt both were on the out and outs of the regime, and they were under a lot of pressure, actually. I think Ernest Jünger's son died as retaliation. Carl Schmitt, I think one of the newspapers actually threatened Carl Schmitt, but like, do you want bullets to the head or something? Maybe I'm getting him mixed up with somebody else, but they were not exactly regime lapdogs. They were very outspoken and what they believed.
But his criticism, at least what I read, I'm not a Carl Schmitt expert, but I have read a little of his work, and his understanding is that he was very critical of the idea of neutrality, state neutrality, liberalism, constitutional law, and his notion of the sovereign, meaning he who decides. And there are times, and the reason why I was drawn to his argumentation is the fact that our liberal order, by its own standards, has failed, meaning it doesn't live it up to its own standards. And when push comes to shove, it's just as authoritarian. In many ways, much more dishonest than like a regime like the Third Reich, which just called it as it was. We're in charge,
Yeah.
and that's it. At least that's honest.
You know
At
what?
the
More
very
importantly, under the Third Reich or the Soviet Union, you knew what the rules were.
yes.
The rules were, everyone knew what they were. They were set in stone. So it was easier to abide it by them. In democracy, you have there's rules and then there's the unspoken rules. Like, you don't have free speech, white boy, shut up, or you'll be fired. Or like January 6th, there's this unspoken rule that a lot of people learned that you as a white person are a second-class citizen. You do not have the same right to protest as the blacks. The blacks
Well,
can
that's what they
literally
mean by
burn things
special.
down.
They have special protected class under civil rights law.
Yeah. And that's a huge thing too. I really liked the book by Christopher Caldwell, The Age of Entitlement,
Excellent
which,
book, yes.
yeah, so it really does a normie-friendly, scholastic, but engaging breakdown of how there has been a second constitutional founding and you have all these special rights and classes which have supplanted the old ones. So really, they're like going back to what you said about how there's no continuity. There absolutely has been no continuity. I would say there's been multiple constitutional revolutions. You had 1789.
Is it every 80 years, about roughly?
It does seem, well, there's been more in rapid succession because I'd say 1789, Civil War, actually FDR, because he began all, I'm going to write an article on this about the, how the stupid commerce clause, which is outdated, about how they try to, during the New Deal, of the explosion of alphabet agencies and regulation, there was a whole new mini constitutional order created. Then, of course, you get to the big one, to the civil rights era. Then we're from 2020 to up to now in this weird, there's been some pushback, thankfully, but a incipient constitutional revolution all over again. So that's the thing. Like, we got to realize that constitutional orders are not magical. Carl Schmitt talks about how the Constitution, the law, it's a theological miracle because we got rid of God. So the constitutional order can't say, well, God has made me king, but it's not to be questioned. This jumps down out of the sky that we're all going to have democracy time now and equality in this stuff. And when you peel it back, it's really just about power. They desacralized it, but it's, okay, why is this special? Why shouldn't we have, like, really, if you, I really like the American regime because it puts things into a historical context of all human history. And this stuff is not special. The Enlightenment, democracy, these are not magical sacred cows. If we're going to deconstruct everything, well, let's deconstruct the deconstructors. Let's deconstruct diversity. Let's deconstruct
democracy. You can't, that's anti-Semitic.
Oh, no. I forgot about the disparate impact theory.
Yeah.
But yes, it's true. These things aren't special. What is the Constitution? Don't get me wrong. I think the Constitution of 1789 is an outstanding constitution. But it's still just that. It's a constitution, which is a means towards an end, which is the nation. And really, it's in the shadow of the pyramids. What is it? We've had priest kings. We've had Spartan craziness. We've had fascist oligarchies, communist regimes, feudal warlords. Some of these things are a little bit better off than straight up democracy. I think Hans Hermann Hoppe does a great job of poking holes at democracy. I know he wants to have anarchism instead of monarchy. I'm for neither anarchism or monarchy. I would prefer something like Starship Troopers or a militarized republic.
Well, it is funny because he points out in his book, another excellent book, by the way, that everyone should read, would be Democracy, the Goddess that Perished or Failed.
The God That Failed.
Yeah, obviously, it's a play on the book about communism, but communism, the God That Failed. But he points out that under even libertarian standards, monarchies are superior to democracies.
They are.
Even Tsarist Russia was a libertarian paradise compared to Republican France or 21st century America.
Yeah, from the standpoint it's true because
everyday life, yeah.
These monarchs, these they don't micromanage their people. They're not nannies. They devolve. They usually delegate power to nobles or an equivalent to handle stuff, and they do not care. They have no interest in, cutting off children's genitals or even taxation is usually pretty lax. They want to keep their people loyal and happy and productive, so they aren't breathing down people's necks. In fact, the nobility were seen as a bulwark against both the bourgeois and the absolutist monarch because they would stand up for the peasants' rights and say, no, we're in charge here. So really, I'm a huge proponent for local government. I don't think we can go back to some, I'm not going to go back to some LARPing thing if I was in power, but I would definitely empower local governments and states and kind of a neo-feudalism where stuff gets devolved.
Yeah, that's a principle of subsidiarity, which is a Catholic principle. The idea that the most local authority possible deals with it because that's the most accountable.
Yeah,
right. Like say, under a regime like, let's say, an authoritarian regime that was one uniparty, like the Third Reich, at least the people knew who was responsible.
Yeah,
and you can say what avenue do they have to respond? Well, the government has to respond somewhat. In a democracy, you don't know in a system like America, we don't know who's, no one's responsible for anything.
I like the term DMVocracy because you get the sense of where do I go to? I have an issue. It's a big issue. Which do I even know which little desk to go up to, which line to wait in?
Yeah.
For example, on one of the January 6th cases, they said, well, some judge was getting all pretentious, said, well, this isn't the right way to do it. You should go to court. But people went to court. And now they're being charged with a bunch of fake crimes and conspiracies and felonies in relation to Trump in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't protest. You can't go to the courts. okay, we can't do anything. Well, maybe I'm just going to stop enlisting. I can't do anything. I'm going to start not doing things.
Yeah.
It's really ridiculous. And it's like, where do I go to? Or will the court, and this is the big thing too, my upcoming speech I made, is that the democracy and the government, they can divide stuff. So the federal military has been able for a long time to distance itself from the other parts of the federal government, like the ATF that murdered dozens of white people at Waco, or the judiciary, which has been out of control, completely out of control, and needs to be disciplined. No, they are all the same. They go to the same elite schools. They all network. They all marry each other's kids off to each other. They're all, or increasingly off to random black people. They all are loyal to the same buzzwords and ideology. They all despise us. They all worship Israel. There is no difference between Republican and Democrat, or the U.S. Army and some judge in D.C. These are all the same. They treat us like all the same. You are whitey. You are the enemy. We need to treat them as all the same. They're all implicated. I had my former congressman, Daryl Issa, he had to go to a different district. I interned for him once, bad-mouthing MTG because she tried to get Mayorkas removed, who's an extremely anti-white, disgusting Jew creature.
Yes.
And Daryl Issa said something.
Literally destroying the country by opening its borders up to hordes from the third world. For the purpose of overwhelming the heritage population.
Correct. And Daryl Issa, who's supposed to be a staunch Republican, which I thought he was once upon a time, I guess I didn't really understand what a Republican meant. It meant the Democrat Party.
Isn't he ethnically Arab or Lebanese or something?
He's Lebanese Maronite, and Lebanese are actually pretty cool, but he doesn't get it. I don't know what's going on there, because the Lebanese should be natural enemies of Israel. I don't understand this. He's a Maronite Christian, which is kind of cool. But this whole thing, it's ridiculous. Issa said this. I don't think MTG has the maturity or experience to understand what she is asking for. I just want to say, you know what? The Democrats don't care. They wield power effectively. They don't care if it's novel. Obama had no problem building power. And nobody would have condescended to Obama and said, well, you don't really know what you're asking for because you're new and you're immature and experienced. No, it's all about power.
Mm-hmm.
And so I absolutely hate these Republicans who refuse to do anything. They'll complain all day long, but you can't even vote to get rid of Mayorkas and at least replace him with another dime a dozen anti-white Jew.
Yeah,
you can't even go through the motions of this.
Can't just get another Jew in there.
I know. It's like, can you at least, you can't even keep up appearances of getting the new ant or
by the way,
Indian like Nimrata.
You remember that Nick there's a Kelly. Famous. Yeah, there's a famous, infamous video rather of Joe Biden. I think right after he was vice president. This might have been the first year of the Trump administration, where he's bragging, or not bragging, he's claiming that there's an unrelenting stream of non-whites coming into the country. Unrelenting, he says, constant. And soon, America will no longer be a majority ethnically white country. And that's a good thing. So Joe Biden says this.
Yeah.
Now, of course, if it's a good thing, that must mean that white people are a bad thing.
Yeah.
And so then again, if they are doing this, it's perfectly appropriate to say, well, I don't want that. I want to make America keep America majority ethnically white for various cultural, political reasons. As you can see, are valid if you see the polling on any number of issues. If you want to keep America, America, if you look at the polling on the issues, whether it's the Bill of Rights or any number of public policy issues, it's going to have to stay ethnically white. Otherwise, it's going to change. That's the whole why there's a great replacement going on. And they deny it, but they praise it when they say diversity is great. But then if you say, well, no, it's not so great, then they call you a racist. But to his right on the video is Mayorkas.
Interesting.
And you watch the video, and it is Mayorkas. And if you look at it, I might be mistaken, but if you look at it, it's Mayorkas there. And then as soon as Biden is installed as president, Mayorkas is installed at DHS. We can undermine the country. These key nodes where they take over, and that's what you have. They install them in these key nodes. And I think there are over 450 Jews in the Biden administration at key places.
Goes into another issue in the book, which is the slippery slope, which is not a logical fallacy.
Oh, by the way, I'm sorry. Before we go off that, I want to of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene, where she'll talk about things like a national divorce and the breakdown of the border and Mayorkas. She won't identify with the fact that Mayorkas is Jewish, and this is a Jewish strategy. She herself,
So MTG is an interesting case study because she hasn't been to Epstein Island. She is. She's acting how someone who is a legit, who is a good faith Zionist who simply misguided would act in good faith. All the other Republicans are acting in bad faith, and it's very transparent. So I think she being an outsider, she hasn't been blackmailed or bribed yet. So she's been a lone voice of reason who's been trying to de-escalate things and to saying, let's not start World War III. And it's weird is that these people. So one of the things I want to research.
Yeah, I think with women politicians, you have to blackmail them because they're not as subject to sexual blackmail. Whereas when it comes to sex, guys are idiots.
Yeah.
So they're easy to blackmail in that area.
But my big question raised by MTG and a little tangent here is how long does a red pill journey take? So a lot of these people might be purple pilled. Like it took me during the Obama regime, it took me like a good year to fully digest all of our ideology and doctrine. You know, so people jump all over Elon Musk and MTG and other people. I always have to say, like, these people might be on a journey too. And just because they're super smart. Now, I was super smart, but it took me a while to digest these things. So I think a good thing to research, which I have some plans to look into, is how long does the average red pill journey take? And what are the major obstacles?
Oh, yeah. When I was, 34 or 35, I thought I was well-informed.
Yeah.
And I may look back 20 years later. When I was 55, I thought I was well-informed. Live, you learn, I guess. At least ideally.
Yeah, it's like I thought I was smart, and then I found Julius Evola, and I realized I was only at the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, that's wisdom combination of experience and knowledge, I guess. You can't get it on the cheap. You have to set to earn it.
I know. But too, a good point that the American regime works is the slippery slope with the dreaded wrong side of history. Going back to what you said about, immigration is happening, but it's a good thing. People, it's a verified thing that book Ray goes into how people have gone, conservatism has failed because they always see ground. They're always defensive. They always get moved along by the overturn window. Like originally the civil rights era, people were not behind it because blacks were acting surprise, surprise, exactly as they did in 2020, just like burning, looting, murdering, chimping out of control. But then because this sassy speaker, MLK, who had some commies ghostwrite his speech, got killed. Everyone had to put that aside. And they trying to find someone who from that era who said, yes, I oppose this. And I'm proud to oppose it because I was vindicated. It's very hard to find people like that.
Well, as I say, Stanley Levinson were alive today, he'd be a conservative.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, I'm old enough to remember in the 80s when Martin Luther King was not a god.
Yeah.
There were standard right-wing Reagan conservatives who were very critical of Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement and Jesse Jackson and called it out for what it was, which was a big, a grift and a con,
Yeah. And now I'm kind of terrified by how the author was correct in his prediction that BLM would be whitewashed, frankly. And the conservatives adopt like this new speaker having a black son and worshiping St. Fentanyl Floyd. A man like that should not be in power. He shouldn't be in charge of a shrimp stand, let alone Congress.
Yeah.
But these people, it's
by the way,
very dangerous.
The son he adopted, the black son he adopted.
Wonderful rap sheet. He's, it's like the Pitbull thing. It's nature breaks through nurture almost every single time.
It's like, but this is the generation that was raised on different strokes, right?
Yeah.
It's like the white savior complex. It's,
I know.
The virtue signaling and these things, and I still went into that. I don't want to be misanthropic, but it lays it on a little thick, and it's same with the true story behind, was it The Blind Side? Ever heard about that? The family that adopted that football player, and they never really adopted him, and they were using him just to raise money.
Goodness, I've never. Is that a movie or something?
Yeah, there's a movie with Sandra Bullock. The real story. He's suing the family now because he's. He's broke. He's a broke retired athlete because he blew through his money, of course. And now he's trying to sue because apparently they used him. What they call boosters for the university. And it's big money. It's a big, it's college sports is a big scam. And they were using him to boost their bona fides, their notoriety. They're a wealthy family to begin with. So it was just very much probably like Speaker Johnson. There was a prop. And they claim to adopt them, they never adopted them. I think they filed some sort of like special corporation or something. They're literally using the
Wow. Yeah, it's weird because like with Johnson, I'm not sure if he's a cynical prop or if they actually got high off their own supply. There is a problem with these Christians, both Protestant and Catholic, just completely incorporating BLM ideology. Because so it happened during the Soviet Union, it was that the Soviets destroyed the churches. But the non-communist left, they learned that was stupid. That simply galvanized people. Why destroy the churches when you can subvert them?
Yes, that's the
Which is
Western method.
yes.
Yes.
So they're, I'm not sure if he actually, it's so weird. It's hard to tell if these people are acting in bad faith or if they've actually have internalized this stuff. And you think someone who's smart enough to be the Speaker of the House would be cynical, but he looks like such a goober. I'm not sure which one is worse, him being this global Ned Flanders or him being a cynical Machiavellian.
Well, his first day, he pledged his support for Israel, and
Gosh golly, it's.
to a bipartisan standing ovation. As I joke, I think they're still clapping. They don't want to stop clapping.
My recent article on Countercurrents, it's paywall, they'll be free in about a month. I went through all his issues with the Black Sun, George Floyd worship, loyalty to Israel, and I said, he's being called a Christo-fascist, more like Judeo-Bolshevik. Look at the policy positions. This is basically right-wing Bolshevism with a MAGA hat.
He's serving their masters,
Yeah.
in the book, though, one thing I was impressed by the book was it goes through the whole cathedral theory, introduces the reader to that, and like I said, there is a lot of validity to that because, again, you academia, media, corporations, these people kind of they live in a very similar environment. They cross-pollinate. It's a community of interest, of outlook, and so yeah, you get that, the elite, whatever. But the problem is one thing an analyst or a writer like Curtis Yarvin overlooks conveniently is there's been a fundamental shift in the elite in the West, particularly in the United States, and this occurred in the 20th century, and this was sort of the Jewish ascendancy, which occurred latter half of the 20th century, particularly after World War II, and that's a key area there because it was after World War II that it became simply just not acceptable to criticize Jewish power or to identify the Jewish collective as as something that must be kind of reined in and controlled or checked with simple criticism. Prior to the war, there were institutional attitudinal checks on Jewish power, sort of a street smart understanding of what Jews represented. And you had something like, even in Hollywood, you had the Legion of Decency and the production code that was enforced by an Irish Catholic, who said things like, you don't want these people controlling the entertainment affair of their country. They're all degenerate Jews. And he could openly talk that way. And there was control. The demographics of the country were different. This was before suburbia. So you had a lot of ethnic identity, particularly Catholic identity, which represented a stumbling block to Jewish cultural hegemony at the time. That collapsed in the 1960s, 50s, and 60s because of suburbia, electronic media, which the Jews dominated in. So there's a lot you have to follow. Is they're obviously the control of Hollywood and how they sort of insinuated themselves in the networks. First the radio stations, and then the television stations, news, information. At the very time the universities were exploding in the 1960s with government funding and also demographics, you had sort of the cultural Marxist takeover of the universities, largely Jewish, just the Frankfurt School, and with how they function with nepotism, they made sure all their friends were hired. And we saw that even with recently with the Ivy League schools, the recent litigation regarding affirmative action and anti-Asian discrimination, not so much anti-white, but anti-Asian, how it came out that the Jews were the primary beneficiary of affirmative action programs, and also the manipulation of the SAT scoring and all that. How they're, well, I think there it was Ron Unz, who did a study, found out their Jews, just based on academic performance, are overrepresented by 1,000% at Harvard. And essentially, you've had the Jewish takeover of Harvard. Of course, this was facilitated because Harvard did away with their anti-Jewish quota system. In the 1920s, Jews were again proliferating at these schools, and they realized this represented a threat to the university because because of Jews. Basically, the Jews represent, they're a separate group, so they had to be reined in a little bit with quotas. They removed those quotas, so the Jews came in, they took over Harvard.
Right.
And now it's essentially, these are Jewish institutions. And we see now with, of course, with Jewish financial dominance, them using their financial power to bend these universities to their will, to a handful of oligarchs and telling universities to shut down pro-Palestinian organizations or organizations that are critical of Israel. So they're literally destroying what remains of the university system, because the university system, if there's any residue of free thought or free speech in universities, you hear things that are not congenial to Jewish interests, and their response is to shut it down. So you've had Jewish ascendancy. And in this book, he covers that, meaning there is a unique problem. There, this is a separate problem, because there is a tangible, identifiable ethnic interest that's being pursued here, and it's completely antithetical to the American system, at least what we think of free thought, free speech, and things. And it's anyway, I'm rambling. I'll let you take it from there.
Well, I think a very important point to take away from all this is that, and the author does a great job hammering this home, is that it's not the what or the how in politics; it's the who. Always the who, because politics is inherently human. And he's saying, you know, say if you were complaining about the World Economic Forum or Harvard, that's like complaining about the Hilton if all these Jewish bigwigs simply had a brunch at the Hilton to plot. It's basically a forum. It's a way of organization. It's not the World Economic Forum. It's the people in it. Those people have names and faces. And look, it's all Jewish names and faces. Same with Harvard. It's, we need to actually crystallize this and start thinking about the human aspect. I think a lot of this comes down to the Faustian role, way of looking at things. We're all into imaginary forces, and there's a lot of Spenglerian autism I could go down to, but basically Faustian's like things that aren't real, things that are like, that's why they're good at electricity, magnetism, and calculus. The Apollonian view is all about what's near and close. That's why they're good at geometry and architecture.
Mm-hmm.
So the Apollonians would simply say, who? So a Faustian would say, communism is spreading. And Apollonian would say, the communists are spreading. The communists are gaining power. They put into the who, not into the force or the system. And so really this is, and we really need to get over this huge issue that the boomers and the TV generation have of hyper-individuality and not seeing, being so adverse to groups, because politics is about groups. It's not about the individual. Your individual vote counts for nothing except maybe a very close city council race. Historically, it's been about groups, one tribe or city state or faction fighting others. That's just how things are. It's a fact of life. It's a fact of nature. And we just need to get back to reality and touch grass instead of adhering to these insane theories. The average conservative adheres to these anti-nature theories like racial equality, which have no bearing in reality. I think we really have to get back to being scientific and stop with the race denial. I think one of the big ways, there are two points that I would really hammer home for this book, is one, you can't deny biology. But the other one, which is almost even bigger and it's a little more perennial, is time. Time is cyclical. It is not linear. Your regime is not a special snowflake. It will melt like all the others. And things have generally gone downhill, not uphill, despite technology. I know Savitri Devi talked about that. And it's hard to, you know, really get people into the Evolian, Spenglerian, Savitri Devi mindset. But the regime is a good primer for someone who's maybe purple-pilled, like someone who's a MAGA mom or QAnon, and show them this wider world and put things in context of both biological reality and time reality. Both putting the regime into a historical perspective and understanding that things come and go. Races come and go, cultures come and go, regimes come and go. Everything is cyclical. I know that sounds like something a hippie would say while they're tripping out on acid, but it's true. Everything is cyclical. It's not linear. Progress is a lie.
So we don't have Star Trek to look forward to?
You have Warhammer 40K to look forward to if we're lucky. Maybe Starship Troopers if we're lucky. I think I really like the book Archaeo Futurism, because the whole it's a pretty simple book, but the premise that the future will be more like the past is a lot more rational. I really do think that the the Enlightenment to 2000 era was a weird bubble in history, and the post-war bubble of 1945 to 2000 was even more of a completely artificial anomaly. It had nothing to do with the past. It was the amount of extreme wealth, TV indoctrination. It's not real. It's like a fantasy land. It's like, you know, Barbie Land from the Barbie movie.
Mm-hmm.
I want to call it Boomerlandia. It's Boomerland. It's this place that simply has no relation to reality.
Well, isn't there
the giant theme park?
Endless credit expansion and borrowing.
Yeah, the green line will always go up, and now we've started having these.
Well, just demographics. What if women stop having babies?
Yeah, that's a huge thing too. And
get best. Now, by the way, that gets us back to biology.
Yeah,
and the
it is
the
indeed.
Difference, yeah,
and Spengler said that once the fundamental questions of life become questionable, life itself is questionable.
Yeah, if women,
that is a great turning point.
If women question whether they should have babies, that's all downhill from there, because it all. I mean, it's if you don't do that, what are you going to fill the breach with third world immigration, right? United States, right? Yeah, and so.
Well, what's disturbing is that the mind virus has spread from the West to all these other countries. Like, the only place in Latin America that has replacement level reproduction is Guatemala. I kid you not.
Well, I tell people, it's the West has become a death cult.
It has. It really is like the focus on abortion. It's whether it's the weird fanaticism for abortion.
It really is
a death cult. Yeah. It's like they have literally summoned. I know it sounds memey. I know it sounds a little schizophrenic, but they have. It's like a Cthulhu cult. They worship death and chaos and insanity. That's what they've unleashed and what they celebrate.
Yeah,
and it's destroying them quicker than it's destroying us. Like, Cthulhu does eat his most loyal followers first. There's some little white pill there, but they're going to do a lot of damage before they destroy themselves.
Yeah, and you eventually get, you know, you see that now with the transgender stuff, the mutilation of children, and this stuff is paid for by some of our most renowned institutions like Johns Hopkins, because that research, you know, this goes back to the 70s. Jewish, of course, Dr. Money and his research, this stuff was tolerated at these supposed medical institutions, this mutilation of children, which is simply, it's like a form of child sacrifice.
That's another point from the book too, is that these are all luxury beliefs, just like how it was the aristocracy of Carthage sacrifice their kids to Baal.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing here is that you can indulge in luxury beliefs, like how boomers could indulge in Zionism because they didn't have to fight the wars and we were prosperous, so we could just send money both to the hood and to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, I see Israel as like a welfare recipient that's always violent and having confrontations with their neighbors, but I digress. These are all luxury beliefs, transgenderism, Zionism, but the age of luxury is very quickly ending. So these luxury beliefs, they're a luxury that we can't afford, and they're going to find out that they can't afford either. So this will catch up with them, but there's a lot of damage to be done. And going back to the Jewish thing, I originally wasn't going to talk about the Jewish question with the Holman Institute, but they have made it impossible for me not to talk about it, especially with the whole current Gaza situation. I can't not talk about it. It'd be more awkward not to talk about it than talk about it. So I have no choice.
So an interesting headline. It goes, Israeli massacre of Palestinians causes rise in anti-Semitism.
I know. It's like there's no filter on them. They've been used to having total media dominance.
They brag about Dresden now. I used to be able to talk about Dresden. You know,
I know.
We'll exaggerate the crimes of the Germans and not talk about saturation bombing. And then they'll say, you know, on one hand, they'll say, we didn't bomb the hospital, but we have to bomb the hospitals. And we're not killing.
And that's a good thing.
That's a good thing because there might be a terrorist in there. And then they say things like, we're not targeting civilians, but we're going to use Dresden as an example. Well, then
like,
you are targeting
civilians. Dresden is a war crime. And the only reason, I mean, really, look, if you look at it, the Allies should have hanged themselves for their own war crimes. I think Nuremberg is going to come back to bite them, because the takeaway from Nuremberg isn't some black letter theory. It's that it is illegal to lose. You got to win no matter what, because if not, you might be killed.
Yes.
And before the most vicious knightly battle, the most, you know, intense feudal blood feuds were less vicious than this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the other books that Antelope Hill published was Gotz von B, which is about a late medieval knight in Germany. And he was put on house arrest by a court. And this court basically dissolved itself because a war happened. So he couldn't appeal his sentence. So he basically sat out his entire sentence in house arrest instead of disregarding it because chivalry and nobody bothered him. And they were always taking prisoners. So this supposedly barbaric time was more humane than modern liberalism or democracy or the post-Nuremberg order.
Yeah, it was. It's been an advance towards barbarism, as a book by that title, and it's an old book. It dates back to the 40s, but it was reflecting on what had just occurred, and people have yet to come to terms with that. And what's disturbing is many people sort of internalize it, use it as an example. You know, the use of firepower. I mean, air power rather, just to bomb people. And the Israelis rely on that too because they don't want to commit the force because they don't have too many people who want to
Oh,
die
they're
for
total
Israel.
coward. Oh, here's the thing. Let me rant about this for a moment. So it's everybody knows who knows anything about war, whether or not you're in the military, you're a strategy gamer, you have to support your tanks with infantry, especially in an urban environment, or they'll be chewed up. Everybody knows this. This is war 101. The Israelis are not supporting their tanks with infantry or other armored vehicles because they're cowards. So Hezbollah, within very close range, can simply blow them up. And these tanks cost $3 million each. And then Israel might have 1,000 of them, but they're blowing through them pretty quickly. This is ridiculous.
We found it with Ukraine. It's sort of you can print endless amount of dollars to pay for the war, but you can't print hardware.
Right.
And this speaks to, again, how we're seeing now, where we see with the recruitment problems, where they're, you know, the armed forces aren't meeting their quotas. They can't recruit people to come, you know, enough people to join the armed forces anymore. Well, it's because Jewish organized Jewry has destroyed America. They're rotting out the culture. They're knocking down the statues, engaging all types of cultural iconoclasm, demoralizing everybody. They're flooding the country with, you know, third worlders. They're waging anti-white cultural warfare, insulting the heritage of America. The very people you want to, who would join the ranks and become cannon fodder, aren't joining anymore. And they're eroding America. At the same time, they're relying on American power for muscle. Well, you can't. So which is it? I mean, it's like
that's why I'm glad they've renamed all the bases that were named after Confederate generals, because they weren't honoring us. They were mocking us and tricking us, because on these same bases named after these great heroes, they were pushing critical race theory, diversity, all sorts of filth, and being slaves to the terrorist state of Israel. They didn't deserve, those bases didn't deserve to be named after Confederate generals.
Well, that was an attempt to reunify the country to support the American Empire, particularly after the Spanish-American War. That's why you had all these, in the latter half, late 19th and early 20th century, these statues go up. It was, in its own way, one level of psychological warfare, yes.
Yeah, when I was in the military, like, every single building is named after a person, it seems like. And by the time I got out, I had to ask, would these people, if that these buildings are named after, if we could, you know, summon them from the dead or force them retirement, they would be disgusted by what goes on in these buildings on a daily basis. So you're actually dishonoring them. This whole thing's a farce.
Well, that's even a military cemetery. If you look at like the Arlington National Cemetery and the Iwo Jima Memorial, how, you know, putting up the flag in Iwo Jima, that's a remarkable statue there. It's a tourist site, but, you know, you know, that photograph was staged. Hate to tell you. It's like, and so what were you dying for? Some rock out the middle of the Pacific so you could then firebomb Tokyo easier? I mean, that's pretty much, I think, what I understand.
Yep. Hey, well,
20,000
truth
people
is the first
died for
casualty
that?
in war.
Yeah, 20,000 people died for that? 20,000 Marines died. Now, I guess.
And the best, those were the best people in our country, too.
Yeah, I'm not, I mean, obviously, I'm not questioning.
I'm very opposed to Jewish wars because they are destroying the best genes of our people.
Yeah, the physical courage that it took to do that, the sense of sacrifice, the tolerating suffering, all that's there.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is the guys destroying the beaches of Normandy or took Iwo Jima were cannon fodder for empire.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bitter pill to swallow, given the sort of the shibboleths we've been asked to accept, or the narratives, if you will. Historical narratives are very important here. Narratives are very important. I run into this all the time when I'm debating various issues. Is I'm dealing with you know, decades of indoctrination and shibboleths and sort of preconceived notions of what America is, what history is, just to deal with one issue.
That's a big psychological issue is that, and I might do some research on this on the side about people's their obstacles becoming red-pilled, but having to admit that you're wrong or tricked is very difficult. For me, I don't have that issue because I'm just too male-brained. I don't like the term autism, but I'm too male-brained to even care about that. I'm a lawyer, poli-sci guy. I can admit I'm wrong. That's fine. It's never
Yeah,
personal.
I've dropped that. I've long ago shed any like ego or pride about being wrong, because I'm not wrong about my principles or general like overall beliefs, but certain historical events I'm perfectly willing to reinterpret and reconsider, and drop, you know, as the evidence, it's kind of like as evidence was presented, I changed my opinions. Maybe I'm weird that way.
And here's the thing. If you were lied to and fooled, that is not to your discredit.
No.
That's to the discredit of the people who fooled you. It is only to your discredit if you continue to be fooled by them. So
Yes.
shame on the regime for lying to us. Like FDR, arming Bolsheviks, were raping nuns and burning churches. The average American would have been aghast at that. He really was a terrorist. FDR should be run knocked down statues. I would knock down FDRs because he was arming communist anarchist terrorists. He was funding terrorism. What else was Bolshevism?
Yeah, he has a
It's
very
like giving arms to ISIS or the Taliban, but
yeah.
worse.
His memorial features, I think there are four for each term. I think the fourth one's a lot smaller, but yeah, there's actually the FDR memorial. There's like four presentations for each term that he, you know. So yeah, that's all part of that.
MacArthur should have had four terms or maybe indefinite terms, but I digress.
Well, again, he may have been president, but was he in charge?
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, it's a good question. Like, I wish I'd seen the Oppenheimer, but I'm not gonna like sit through 3 hours of that nonsense. But it seems like FDR, like really, like he was, how much of a front man was the American Caesar of our time? I don't know. I mean, he was surrounded by communists and Jews, and they were always seemed to be the real power.
Well, isn't that the route of the American regime? Is it's an oligarchy,
Yeah,
and
it's
all the,
basically, if I could basically summarize what the American regime is, it's a racial oligarchy of Jews and their pets. Which is highly aligned with chaos, but now chaos is destroying them. That's the American regime.
So there's hope.
There is hope. It's a
There's always
very,
hope, I guess. I'm not gonna say that. There's always
it's
hope.
a, it's a realistic hope. I like a lot of the book talks about Oswald Spengler, and that's probably one of my favorite authors, which is why it spoke to me a lot. But Spengler said optimism is cowardice. We need to stop d deluding ourselves with this idea we can back to the 90s or we can pass a bill. None of that. I think the vision that the book provides is realistic, where this regime will destroy itself. We can help hasten it, especially with depriving the regime of its recruits. I am looking into starting a TikTok campaign or something where we're going to be a bunch of veterans telling young Zoomers don't enlist. But there is light at the end of the tunnel. These are horrible truths to accept, but we have to accept them to have a chance at survival. And just keeping this within the perennial worldview that evil is usually stupid and destroys itself, that's an optimism that isn't cowardice. It's an iron pill that you have to swallow.
Yeah, it's evil doesn't have a positive existence,
Right, it's
and so
unnatural, and what is unnatural has difficulty surviving, like test tube babies or transgenders. But the more like transgenders commit suicide just because they're so unnatural. They can't deal with the reality.
well, yeah, and there's a whole the yes of why are they so confused and victimized? Is it a toxic environment, toxic culture? You know, they themselves are a generation that's been victimized by decades of cultural warfare. You know, the sexual revolution, degeneracy being promoted by the group that you mentioned that control the media in Hollywood. And why are they presenting that message? And why they should be allowed to present that message, you know, in the first place? Why allowed to destroy? There was a time in a society when society wasn't democratic. It was, you know, so it was you had confessional states that were definitively Christian societies, particularly Catholic societies, and they would say things like, a group like the Jews cannot be allowed to have control over media or finance because they'll use it to manipulate and destroy, which they have. And there was the idea of principle of sicut Judaeus non, which is the Jews should be left unmolested, but they cannot be allowed to corrupt or destroy society. And the problem is that in liberal societies, this is something that's in the wake of the French Revolution and Napoleon, your Jewish emancipation or liberal society, or sorry, Western societies then being liberal in constitutional republics, let their guard down. Liberalism only functions in an environment of reciprocity. If there's no reciprocity and one group decides to act in bad faith, that group's going to have a distinct advantage as it manipulates and schemes, especially if it's in a position to control the narrative, control media, and deny other groups the necessary identity where they can coalesce and fight back and check, at least give negative feedback. Modern liberalism says, we're all just individuals. And if you do coalesce, well, that's fascism. In fact, it's pathological. That's what the authoritarian personality published by the American Jewish Committee says, that if you identify any, proper authority, particularly male authority, patriarchal authority, and or you have sort of any coalescence of ethnic white, particularly Christian, white Christians, the same thing, really, in the way the Jews see things, that's pathological and it leads to fascism. And because of the world, because of World War II and Hitler experience, we can't allow that to ever happen again. Never again, never again, never again. Of course, that's not true because the very subversion that the Jews were engaging in the post-war era, they were engaged in before the rise of Hitler and the Third Reich. So
Right. So
that's
one of the big issues here is that America has no historical memory right now. And the Jews are allowed to get away with everything because without a historical memory, we don't remember all the problems that they have caused and the
well, that's
wisdom
why
of our
the Yeah,
ancestors.
that's why the October 7th attack by Hamas was unprovoked, because there's no
I know.
memory.
History began on October 7th. It began in 2016 when the Orange Man was elected for absolutely no reason at all. It began in 1945, 1776. And no, it's so artificial to cut off and make an island of ourselves from the rest of really the human experience. Not just the European experience, but all of humanity. And yes, it's the most salient aspect of that is becoming ignorant of the Jewish question, but just all the wisdom of the ages, that there should be tradition, order, what makes a society work. America's not based on tradition or tried and true methods. It's based on theory. So it's doomed to fail.
It's an experiment, right?
It is. I mean, there is a part of it that is blood and soil and real, but it's been, I think, there was always that
Well,
dichotomy, that
that's what made it
tension.
work as long as it has, because despite all the highfalutin Enlightenment ideas, there's reality, and you do have regionalism, localism,
Right.
families. You have, Southern culture. You have the Midwest and
Yeah.
production and farming, agriculture. Even at one time, I would think finance facilitated this, and then finance became dominant and parasitical because it's taken over production and agriculture to actually suck the life out of that. And it's all
Right.
became th this speaks to Jewish finance, and because this leads to de-industrialization, the destruction, depopulation, which speaks to your thesis about evil destroying itself.
Right. And if I
Usury
could,
is unsustainable.
right. And I think the book, a good point that the book, probably the most important, I mean, I said this so many good points, but the state is opposed to the nation. The book and Patriot Front are really hammering home that nation and state are not the same. They should not be confused with each other. If I had to take the one simple thing that could be broken down, the most simplest point, it'd be nation is not state. State hates nation. So you can be for the nation. In fact, being for the nation requires you to be against the state.
Yeah, how many states has France had?
A gazillion. And you know what? They're still French, or
Still French,
we'll see
yes.
what happens, but with all this,
And I would
replacement, like,
argue America has had multiple states too. It goes back to the myth of continuity. It's just
right.
it's sold as again that just speaks to that progress pro history is progress, the Whig history. Everything's getting better. These things, and well, no, that's not the way things work. I'm looking at my wall here. I have Thomas Cole's painting, The Five Part Series, The Course of Civilization. And it starts out, you know, with the savage state, the agrarian state, you know, the consummation of empire, then collapse, and then you have desolation. Then it starts again, you know. So it's a course. It's yeah. And again, it's
And it'd
not
be
in.
extreme hubris to think that just because reasons or freedom or democracy that somehow the cyclical rules of time and history don't apply to us too.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's yeah. It's the savage state, the pastoral state, consummation of empire, collapse, tragedy, and then desolation. I think yeah. It's a he was art at Hudson River School artist in the early 19th century. I think it took him 20 years to paint this series.
Oh,
But
nice.
again, it gives you an idea. Wow, look at this. It's a, you know, over the course of 1,000 years. And what's funny, I think in this painting, there's a rock, there's a mountaintop that never changes.
Nice.
It's
I like that then because it just kind of point out that nature stays the same.
yeah.
Whenever I go hiking, get away from politics and all that, it's very refreshing to know that no matter what happens with political drama, cultural drama back there, there's still a mountain stream here. Hopefully the regime won't pollute and destroy it, but there's some stability there. It's always there. There's something solid that can resist the evils unleashed by certain types of human.
And also, it will give you a certain amount of serenity and acceptance because, given that we're only given so many years, 80 and 10, and after that it's all gravy, they say, is we're not given to see how these things turn out. We're just called to do what's right for the time that we're here, and so we may not see, you know, the revolution, if you will. It's like bliss was that dawn to be alive, but too young was heaven. Well, that was the French Revolution. That was a disaster. So it's kind of like you tend to accept these things as you get older and wiser. Hopefully, that all you're not going to know how these things turn out. And also, you were dealing. The events we're seeing now are playing out isn't just the ephemeral world of today's politics. It's this is a we're seeing culmination of literally centuries of human, you know, experience and trials being played out. Like I think right now we're probably at the end of an epoch. Probably past the 500-year cycle that we've been living in is maybe coming to an end. It's very hard as individuals to identify that and to deal with that, at least in the realm of politics, electoral politics, which is very short-sighted. It's the next, particularly in the West,
I think that's
very.
why it's so important that we have history, religion, and mythology, because the underlying theme for all of them is that you just have to do what's right no matter what sometimes. Like
Yes.
Lord of the Rings, where Frodo, Aragorn, Gandalf, they don't know if they're gonna win. I remember the first time I read that, I almost wanted to punch Tolkien at some points. It was like torture. I was on the I, 'cause it was before the movies when I was a little kid. You don't know they're gonna win. It looks like they're going to all die or be enslaved, and this looks horrible. Or the Persian invasion of Greece, the Spartans died at Thermopylae, not knowing that there would be a final victory. These things have to you just have to be like the what Spengler's called the lone guard out at where was it that place that got blown up? Wasn't Pom maybe it was Pompeii, or I think there's another place. And simply stay at your post. This is what it is to be a man. This is greatness. And just have a little faith that even that you may not see victory, but maybe what you can do will contribute towards it.
Yeah, and that helps make sense of everything.
Yeah.
And the acknowledgement what we're seeing here, the kind of, I think it is metaphysical, it's evil here. And so at least personally, I do what I can, what work I can do to, you know, all things considered, raising a family and all that, those responsibilities. But also work as if it all depends on you and pray as if it all depends on God. And then
Yep.
see what how it turns out.
Right.
So, and understanding, at least as a Christian, our definition of victory is a guy crucified to the cross. So they might understand our the little martyrdoms were made to suffer day in and day out as we deal with these things, you know.
Yeah.
So,
As I think Julius Caesar said, it's easier to find 100 men willing to die for the country than one who's willing to endure pain with patience.
yes, that's right. So, well, the book. The American Regime, I guess people can get it at the Antelope Hill, right?
That's correct. Antelope Hill.
Antelope Hill. And well, I said I'd have you for an hour and a half, and I'll be true to my word. I think we're coming up on that. I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks. It was great to be here, and I really loved talking with you. It was very interesting.
Thank you. Is there anything you want to pitch or any, before you go, or?
Yes. So if you'd like to follow my work, we have a website for the home. It's homelandinstitute.org. Also, if you go to Twitter and just type in David Zutty, last name Zsutty, you can find my Twitter account. I also have a Telegram account that's linked there, I believe. So if you want to follow me there, you get to see my third poll, which will be released probably in a no later than a month from now. And some other things I'm doing, and that'd be great.
Thank you. I'll let you go, and I'll provide the links. Thank you so much. Well, you're abroad. Do you still celebrate Thanksgiving?
I'll try to.
Okay. Happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas.
Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving. Merry Christmas.
Take care. Bye-bye.